There are different ways of approaching archaeology, and one of them is to look at material evidence, such as this sculpture, which is outside the Western Hotel opposite Stanford University, if any of you have seen it. It was designed by sculptor Dave Middlebrook, and it's supposed to represent the ancient and the modern, with influences coming from the Neolithic in Europe. And you can't actually see them there, but there are cave paintings from Lascaux which he's etched onto the inside. So it's quite a neat thing if you want to go and check it out. But another approach, and the approach that I'm researching at the moment for a book, is applying archaeology as a process to the way that people are collecting computers. And this is particularly appropriate in this vintage computer setting. So some of the things I'll be talking about are really the way that we as archaeologists perceive the world. So I'm hoping that we can have some sort of discussion off the back of that about how you perceive the world as vintage collector, vintage computer collectors, or with an interest in it. Now, I've called this Ada's Things as a bit of a tribute to Ada Lovelace, the acknowledged first ever programmer, and I'll come back to Ada a bit later on, but I'm going to launch straight into a piece of archaeology. This is a place called the Treasury of Atreus in Mycenae, which is in mainland Greece. It was a Bronze Age site, so it's about 3,500 years old. And you'll see there are two columns on either side. They're actually representations of columns that were there originally. What happened was, and I don't know how much you're aware of European history, but in the 19th century, there was a great fun to be had in going off on a grand tour of Europe and coming back with all sorts of archaeological spoils, such as statues, bits of masonry, the sorts of things that no one thought would be missed. And in fact, people were readily able to take things back to their homes and put them on display. What happened here is that these two columns were removed by a man called the Marquis of Sligo, who had a large estate on the west coast of Ireland. The Marquis of Sligo went on this trip when he was a young man with a friend of his, Lord Byron, who was, of course, the father of Ada Lovelace, which brings those two neatly together, I hope. The reason I'm bringing this up is that what I'm concerned about looking at things in Silicon Valley is the way that things have changed over time. So this example that I'm telling you about is change over time over about 150, 200 years. What's happening in Silicon Valley, the way that I'm perceiving it, is that things are changing so rapidly that you've got, in the case of vintage computers, items that are defunct and valuable at the same time. And that, in terms of archaeology, is pretty much something. I mean, we're used to dealing with millennia or centuries. We dig down, we can see these layers of time. What's happening, as far as I'm concerned, is that everything's happening at the same time. You drive along El Camino and you see signs of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 21st century, all happening at the same time. And that's a lateral way of thinking, and that is actually pretty exciting if you're an archaeologist. So what happened with these columns was that Sligo took them back to Ireland, or rather he attempted to take them back to Ireland. On the way back, he decided that he didn't trust the sailors he had on board to get them back safely, so he kidnapped a few more on the way. When he got halfway across his journey back, he decided not to keep the sailors on board because he thought they would talk, so he abandoned them on an island. One died, two survived, and they eventually, about a year later, got back to England and told the authorities what Sligo had done. Now, interestingly, Sligo's crime at the time was not taking statues which we would now regard as valuable away from a site, but the fact that he had kidnapped these seamen at the time of the Napoleonic War, which wasn't a very good thing to be doing. There was a notorious court case. Sligo was fined and jailed. The judge fell in love with his mother because she put up such an impassioned plea for him. Eventually he married her. The marriage didn't last, apparently. So there we have it. We have these columns which were suddenly transported from their original context in Greece to become spoils of a trip, a lad's trip abroad, for want of a better way of describing it. And then they become evidence in a court case because they weren't valuables. They were just something that Sligo's defence put up as being the reason why he managed to or wanted to kidnap these sailors, because he had valuable things he wanted to bring home. So you have the same columns changing over time. There's a point I'm making here. Stick with me. So they become evidence, and then they were forgotten about. They ended up back in the Marquess's house in Sligo, and they were put in a basement, forgotten about for 100 years. Now, what happened was archaeology changed as a discipline over 100 years. People began to realize that there was a different sort of value in materials such as this. It wasn't okay to go out to a site and just grab anything, bring it back with no context, and say, hey, this is mine, I just found it, and doesn't it look cute in my house? So there was much more of an impetus to find out more about these things, what their original context was, and to put them in museums, put them on display, make them publicly accessible. So, as I said, 100 years on, one of the descendants of Sligo is rooting around, quite literally in the basement of this house, in Westport House, finds the columns, and thinks they might be of interest. He actually made plaster casts of the base of the column, went over to Mycenae and matched them all together, and found, bingo, these are the columns that were there. So he then made some approaches to museums to see whether anyone would want them, and eventually he gave them to the British Museum. And if you go to the British Museum archive, you can see all the correspondence about the people going across and authenticating the columns, bringing them back, and they're now on display in the British Museum. So the point of all of this is to show how over time things change. So when I'm talking about Ada's things, it's a way of talking about computation, things to do with early computing, to do with historical computing, which now have a different value. When I was giving a radio interview yesterday, I was asked, well, why is it people collect computer things? You know, isn't it a strange thing to collect? And I feel as though if you have a passion for something, then that's why you collect it. In the way that people like Sligo had a passion to collect these columns and bring them back, that's what we're talking about today with vintage computers. Now, I went to a sale in Boston earlier this year, and I love the slogan on that, do it electrically. And it was a sale of science and technology, which was fascinating in itself as an event, because it began with the sale of automata, singing birds, dancing dolls, and went right through early telephones, right through into the main piece of the sale, or the most interesting piece for me, which was a piece of ENIAC. It actually sold for $30,000, this piece, to someone from Seattle. Not that one from Seattle, but someone very close. And what was, again, particularly interesting about this in the context of the sale, apart from the fact that for me to sit there, it was like watching a whole history of technology flowing in front of me with all these objects and artifacts, was that this piece of ENIAC was being sold in context. Presper Eckert, who was one of the designers, who's on the right here, his widow had given this piece up for auction, and it was being sold with all sorts of documentation, Presper Eckert's toolkit, and all sorts of other materials that provided a context for this piece of equipment. And this is really something that I want to develop just here. Because when we're talking about vintage computers and those of you who collect them, in terms of archaeology, it's important to retain a context. Now, whether that means you're keeping the manuals together, whether you're keeping the original boxes, whether you're keeping little slogans, stickers that people have put on the computer. You know, if you're that interested in preserving the vintage quality of this computer, hold on to these things as well, because in years to come, they're telling the story of the object. And this is what, you know, we're getting towards, that the vintage computer is not just a lump of metal, a lump of plastic. It's got a quality which is something quite intangible, something that's really quite hard to define, And so that's why I'm flipping back to archaeology and trying to talk about archaeological artifacts and how they have a certain something that we can't quite quantify. So this is from Sam's collection, actually, a lot of these objects here. So in terms of collecting, it's not just the computer, it's the things that go with the computer. It's all the early materials. It's like the excitement of your own computer in this kit. It's also things like advertisements. This comes from the Computer History Center at NASA Ames, which I'm sure you're all aware of. This was actually on the front of a Neiman Marcus catalogue, and someone had the neat idea that maybe a housewife would love to have all her recipes on a computer and that she would have a kitchen big enough to keep it like that. Apparently they didn't sell a single one, but I think it's a wonderful object, and it actually is in the Computer History Center if you want to go and have a look. That's the center itself for those of you who aren't familiar with it. So we're talking about all sorts of computers. We're talking about, there's the man himself on the side there. It's a rather odd picture. It looks like he's doing something rather dubious there. So it's not him, it's my picture. The collection of large computers as well as small ones. How do you keep these sorts of things in context? You know, this is another issue that we need to think about in terms of vintage computing. It's an odd thing to collect in terms of size. Not everyone has a house big enough. Except I went to the Malibu Hills not so long ago to look at a collection of deck computers that a man had there. And he had this house right up in the mountains, and it was absolutely full of deck equipment, some of it as big as this. There wasn't room for anything else. There was, you know, his whole life revolved around this equipment. And what was extraordinary, and again comes back to archaeology, was that this man was moving to India. So he decided to put all of his collection in what was crated up and sent off to Europe to another collector there in Germany. And in terms of trade, when you think of the movement of those objects, you know, deck computers made on the East Coast, ended up on the West Coast, ended up in Malibu, for goodness sake, and then they go all the way back across to the, well, which way around they would go, they go across to Europe, and they put in a collection there. When we think of archaeology, and we think of maritime archaeology, for example, and shipwrecks, and we try and piece together the evidence of the journey from the shipwreck, what on earth would you think if you had, if something happened to that equipment, the crate fell off the ship, and you're ending up with a whole load of deck equipment in the middle of the ocean and someone retrieves it? You know, how on earth would you work that story through? And that's why I'm trying to tell you more about, or encourage you more about keeping things together, keeping the story together of the object. This is a slide from the Intel Museum, which you probably know of in Santa Clara. They have a massive collection there. They've got about 80,000 artifacts, all to do with Intel and development of the chip. And what they also do there is they keep together, and you can just about see there at the bottom of the slide, notes that the engineers have given. So you've got engineers talking about their process, their history, their personal attachment with bits, quite literally, of computers. And that's utterly fascinating, to me at least. So they're aware of the oral history and the way that we just have to hold on to things like that, because, you know, in a sense we think of the computer world, oh, everything's moving so fast, we don't need to hold on to stories. And in fact we do, because the engineers working there are now in their 60s and 70s, and something needs to be done to hold on to these stories, otherwise they go with the materials. Sorry, this takes a long time to load. Right. Another thing is obviously printouts and other sorts of paper paraphernalia that go with computers. I've been based at Oxford University, and when I was preparing material for this research, I went to the computer center there and asked them if they had any archive material that I could look at. And they said, well, you know, we've got stuff from the 80s, but it's not particularly interesting. But, you know, here's a box. Just go through it. And I went through and found this. And I thought it was quite cute to show you, because it says there the subject is first reply from foreign user. Hooray. And that was only in 1988. you know, that's 12 years ago, and yet you look at it, and to me it's like looking at a manuscript. You know, it's really extraordinary that that has that sort of antique quality, or vintage quality. I'm also looking at people using computers in a modern context. And again, let's flip back to archaeology. If we excavate a grave, and I'm not, these guys are very much alive, they're not dead. If we excavate a grave, what we're finding is people laid out with things attached to them that we then make the story to do with these people. We make a deduction. We decide whether somebody is, you know, a king or someone of high authority, a priest, what have you. It's easy to do that in that sort of context. But what would you make of people today walking around in Silicon Valley? How would you tell the CEO from the engineer in that lineup? So that's what I'm saying about making sure that we keep that personal history alive. In terms of context as well, this is, I can't remember whether this was at Sam's, no, he's denying it. I think it might have been at a place called Weird Stuff. No? Okay, Mike Quinn Electronics. See, the context is there. I looked at that and I thought, oh, wow, that reminds me of an archaeological site. You know, you could go through all of that stuff and you could photograph it as I've done there. You could plan it. You could go through and suppose you just walked into that 200 years on. And you're trying to make sense of what's going on there. I mean, that's what we do, again, in archaeology. We presume we can walk into a site and we can make sense of what's going on without knowing the social life of things that have gone on behind it. So that's another example there. In terms of collecting, you know, nothing is too small. You can look at the chips, and one of the fun things I'm going to be doing with Sam at some stage is dismantling a computer right down to its final components and trying to work out where all of these things come from. You know, what is the range of distribution? Again, something else we do in archaeology, we look at a pot. We look at, we analyze the provenance of the materials that pot was made of. And, you know, we can do the same sort of thing with a computer. We can look at the components. We can look at the raw materials and where they came from. I'm interested in recycling. You know, what happens to those raw materials after they've been, they're not wanted anymore? You know, where do they end up? Recycling, again, you might be surprised to know that recycling was very big in prehistoric times, certainly in the Mediterranean, around the Bronze Age that I was talking about earlier on. So something else to think of. Not such a strange analogy, I hope you would think. You obviously know what that is, a regular apple. But again, in a sense, we get so used to seeing things that are regular that in a way we forget to collect them. And I think that's another issue that's coming up today, that it's almost like saying, oh, I thought you'd collected that. Oh, no, I thought you'd collected that. And if we're not careful, and this is something that Sam and all of you vintage computer collectors are addressing, the fact that somebody has to take responsibility for holding on to these items that go through. I mean, obviously, Apple are going to hold on to it. And obviously, the big computer history centers are as well. But in terms of personal attachment to a computer, you know, why not hold on to your computer that you wrote a thesis on or you wrote something very special on? You know, that's sort of rather like holding on to photographs in a sense. It's holding on to something that's part of your history. And I think we're not quite there yet, but in a few years' time, I think people will hold on to bits of technology as being part of their history in a way they hold on to other things today. So back to Ada, and I'm just going to conclude this because I'd like to open it up for discussion. Something that really brought to my attention how far we've gone in 150 years is a situation I was in when I was back at Oxford. I was going through some material, letters between Babbage and Ada Lovelace, and I mentioned the automata early on and the technology, and Babbage, I don't know how many of you know, was very fond of dancing, dancing girls, automata, and singing birds. And there was a letter that I found that was in an archive at Oxford that was from Babbage to Ada Lovelace, inviting her to go and look at his Silver Lady. And she had had new accoutrements and been overhauled. So that's what this letter was all about. So I was sitting there reading the letter and reading other things that went with it. And I found, to my surprise, when I lifted up my laptop and opened up the computer to make some notes, that Ada's picture was suddenly there. And this was a Thumbs program. I'd put all these slides in, 40, 50 slides a while back. And somehow, me being a non-techie, I'd hit something so that my back projection was Ada Lovelace. So there I was, sitting in this in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, with Ada's letters in front of me, holding onto them, reading from these amazing manuscripts, beautiful copperplate writing, with her picture, which was being brought to me by way of having scanned her picture into this little biocomputer. And there were 150 years of difference. That's no time at all. And again, in terms of archaeology, it's a nanosecond. It's nothing. So I'm just going to end on that observation. And as I said, perhaps we can open it up to discussion if any of you have got any questions. Thank you.
Stuff and how the history is all happening so fast. Are there other people that are getting into this? Is this becoming a real subject in archaeology, or is it still very new?
No,
is this your main thing? Is this a hobby for you?
No, I'm writing a book for MIT Press, which should be out next year. So, that's why I'm doing it. I just found, in fact, the reason I came to Silicon Valley. I mean, it's a rather strange story. You can blame an American airline, actually, which put me on a flight to San Jose instead of San Francisco. I was bumped off a flight from Phoenix to San Francisco. And so I ended up on this San Jose flight a year ago, almost a year ago today. Complete non-techie. You know, I could barely send an email attachment, and I'm still at that stage now. But so I was sitting on this flight, and on one side was a guy who, it turned out, was working in the microprocessor field. And on the other side was a guy who had a Palm 7 that he was feverishly working on, and then was rather frustrated that he couldn't carry on, obviously, when we were lifting off. And I looked at it and I said, "Oh, that's cute. How long's that been out?" And he turned to me and said, "I worked on the email for it. It comes out tomorrow." And I just thought, "Oh, that's interesting." And I sat there on the plane thinking, what a coincidence. Two people working in high tech, you know, on either side of me. And of course, I was probably the only person on the plane who wasn't working in high tech. And so got to San Jose and went off to San Francisco, did what I was planning to do. And something sort of bugged me. I thought, there's something going on there. I want to be part of that vibe. And I write for Archaeology Magazine, which is based in New York. And they were keen for me to go and explore the Intel Museum. I suggested that as a possibility. Again, are people collecting computers? And I had no idea at that point just how widespread it was. So I came back just this last January and went to the Intel Museum and realized just how big, how the scale of this thing. Found Sam's website and everything took off from there. And I thought, this is amazing. And I touched base with the guy who had been working on the Palm 7. In fact, he was one of the guys in the lineup. And it moved on from there, and I've just found it utterly fascinating. And it's been a bit like a website in itself. You know, every person I've spoken to has given me six other people to go and see that I absolutely have to interview. So that's how it happened. Yeah. Hi.
What kind of programming did you do?
Well, it's very. I mean, I'm not a computer historian. She says very quickly. But she was regarded as having done the first sort of mathematical programming in the, let me see, I'd say about 150 years ago. I mean, mathematics was her main field. But she did enough that the Ada language was named after her. But can anyone help me out there? Anyone know anything more about Ada's? Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, well, there are arguments about
the extent to which some program or some would say, all really good things left out came to that over out of you. She was his manager. But not at home, but one of the people for mathematics people, I guess they should work.
Yeah. What about the Descartes? How do you do those things out of that in there, like programming?
Well, she's one of a couple of women associated. I mean, the COBOL is also associated with women. But yeah, Augustus de Morgan was certainly Ada's mentor in a way. And again, his letters to her, or their correspondence, is in the Bodleian Library. And I was looking at that as well. And what was fascinating was that they were talking about the sorts of problems that people have today in terms of dealing with computers, of getting headaches, of working too long hours. You know, isn't that extraordinary? But at the same time, why not? But certainly Ada had a great sort of compulsion to do the work that she did. And probably it won't be till, you know, a significant period before we can look back and see exactly what her role was. Yeah.
Have you looked into also the software side of this in terms of the archaeology 200 years from now?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. I was sort of getting to it when I was looking at the printouts. I mean, how do you archive web things? I mean, it is something ethereal, and yet we're dealing with tangible things. When we talk about an artifact, it's something which is quite solid, and yet there is this area of virtual artifacts, which is really important. And again, it's too easy to lose the history of something. If you look at Photoshop, it has an archive in it by which you can go back and see what you've actually done to create an image. And, you know, that sort of needs to be done for everything. I know we're going to be awash with information at this rate, but in a sense, we don't quite know what to throw out. And if we start throwing out things that we then need, because it's ethereal, it's completely gone. Yeah. I think I wanted to take you first. Yeah, thanks.
You mentioned the fascinating interviews that you have conducted. So certainly being able to conduct interviews is one of the main differences between being a historian and being archaeologist.
Absolutely.
So my question is, what kind of methodologies you are finding useful? Methodologies taken from archaeology, you are finding useful in your actual
I think, as far as archaeology is concerned, it's a perspective where I almost think of it as, what if Pompeii happened here? You know, how could we work things out? How bizarre would things look? How much of the social interaction is missing that we need to try and reconstruct? And so when I'm asking the questions, I'm trying to sort of build up that picture. But it's a very valid point you're making, because obviously we don't and we can't ask anything of the dead when we're excavating skeletons. But perhaps what I'm saying as well is that because we have the possibility of asking the questions of, for example, an Intel engineer, you know, what were the processes, how did he feel at certain stages, you know, I'm using that sort of methodology.
When archaeology becomes modern history, the transition from archaeology to modern history, perhaps at the point that we can still access pioneers, access people of importance, and we can talk to them. So
yeah.
This way you want to.
Absolutely. It is a sliding scale, isn't it, of knowledge. But I recently did some research on Second World War defences in Britain, and that's regarded as archaeology. You know, it was in Archaeology magazine. And yet I can go and talk to people who lived through that experience. They could tell me about a bomb hitting a certain site. And that's all part of that. That's archaeology. So archaeology as a field is moving very rapidly. It's changing from the old idea that you have to be digging in order to be doing archaeology. There's a lot of social side that comes into it. And anthropology. And I'm aware that in America, archaeology perhaps is defined rather differently to Britain. But we use a lot of anthropology.
Thank you.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So, as historians, I guess it's a lot more trouble to find things that you discovered that a lot of the material for New England was only just recent from the classics. So, a lot of that history you did not know until this point of years.
Yeah, no, that's a very valid point. That's why it's important if companies themselves have their own archive. I mean, even if we can't access it or what we're accessing, I mean, at Intel, I'm not seeing the whole lot. You know, I'm seeing what I'm allowed to see. Yeah. And some of the processes are also, you know, intellectual ones. It's people sitting down with a cup of coffee, throwing ideas around, and you can't reconstruct those necessarily. In fact, you can't reconstruct that actual moment. But what you can do is try and get some idea of the energy that was going on at the time. Yeah. Yeah.
It's also the point that ongoing. So things that may look very important 100 years from now are just being thrown away because they're not important now.
Absolutely.
That product's obsolete, forget it.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's the point of actually this festival, isn't it? That we're celebrating things that other people think are downright ugly. You know, let's be frank about it. Or too big to hold on to. Or, you know, what's the point? It's out of date. But that's my original fascination, that something is out of date, defunct, and yet collectible. And also, if you look at things geographically, a lot of the stuff that is around here won't reach Britain for a year, 2 years. You know, it's like a sort of time lapse. So you've got that issue that comes into it as well. Yeah. Anyone else?
There was a time when I could look at the computer and tell you where it was made.
Really? That's amazing.
On the window computer and on the office computer and the car computer.
Wow.
By the construction. Just the cabinetry.
Gosh, that's incredible. That's a wonderful skill. When did you stop being able to do that, though? You know, when did they become sort of generic and you couldn't take it?
Oh, I think I went away from
it. Right.
I changed jobs and it wasn't important then.
Uh-huh.
But now it's okay because I made all the pressure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. Great. Anyone else? Right. Okay. Well, thanks so much for your comments. I appreciate it.